You're listening to Ink Studs, and my guest this week is Katie Skelly. Katie's been on a couple of times in the past. Last time we talked and did an interview was in 2014. But then you've also been interviewed by the Fantastic Jog back in 2017 and did your own interview with Liz Suburbia back in 2015. So a longtime friend.
It's great to be back. It's great to be back, and I'm so happy that Ink Studs has returned. It's like comics has really come full circle, you know? We needed it. I feel more comfortable. I'm more at ease in the world of comics now that I know Ink Studs is back.
You're too kind, really. Mm-hmm. Too kind. No, I appreciate it, and I fondly remember like when I first came across your work with getting those tiny little nurse mini comics in the mail, and it's really interesting to see kind of where you've gone with your work and where you're going with your work. One of the things is the publicist Tucker sent me a quote from a thing about your new book, Heaven, is kind of the end of your good girl phase. And I was fascinated by that. And I was also like, they're good girls? I guess in this book, they're kind of good girls, but a lot of your girls are bad or mm-hmm. just troublesome.
Yeah. I think it might have been cool girls and not good girls. Okay. I'm surprised if they are good girls. That would
maybe it is.
That, would, cool that girls. Could be the new direction.
Yeah, maybe I was just that would make a lot more sense, and then now I just sound dumb. So
no,
there we go. I should also mention Katie is the co-host of the Thick Lines podcast along with Sally Madden, which I took a look, and that's been you're up to almost 200 episodes.
Yeah. Madness.
Tell me about the commitment to keep going.
I
as a podcaster.
That's Robin, I wish I understood so I could like stop. But I don't know. It's something that I just feel like, well, listen, I don't want to be on social media anymore, but I still need to like release propaganda. You know what I mean? So I feel like it's mostly that. It's like in 2021, you know, we were still in the thick of it in quarantine in New York. And Sally and I, my good friend Sally Madden, who is now the co-editor at the Comics Journal Online, we would talk on the phone like every day. And we would just joke that we were doing a podcast together. Like, oh my God, people should tune in. And then we decided, you know what? Let's just do it. I think it'll be fun and stupid and funny. And we got started and we did our first episode and we talked about Hate by Pete Bagg. And it was just a blast. And then Pete Bagg like liked the episode and shared it. And it was like, oh shit. We're like, okay, so I guess we have immediately found purchase in this world, which is like the worst thing that can happen, Robin, you know, because that means you have to keep doing it. So
yeah, I mean, Pete was an early interview for me where I'm like, okay, I can keep doing this. It's all right. So your new book, Heaven, it's, you know, I spent the last couple of days reading through a stack of comics of yours. I don't know where my copy of Operation Margarine or Nurse are, but the other works, The Agency, My Pretty Vampire, Maids, plus your two, Visir, and did I pronounce it right?
I say Visir, and people Visir. Get upset with me because it's a little bit of a like nonsense word, nonsense title, but I say Visir, and I'm American, so I'm just stepping all over every other language. Doesn't matter.
I will say Visir. So yeah, I spent, you know, as one does for a prep for an interview, and one of the things I'm immediately fascinated by is how it's a book where a strip club is a main piece of it, but looking at your other work, it's surprisingly cast in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested about like moving into a direction to be really specific in that telling a story in a way without about, you know, including a strip club as a predominant feature, but not falling into a lot of the traps that it would pull you in.
Yeah. It was something that, like, I just wanted to really build an atmosphere. And in building that atmosphere, I thought it was going to take on a certain direction. And I thought, you know, I started it in 2021. It was like right after, shortly after I'd moved to Los Angeles to be with my fiance, now husband, Jaime. And sorry, someone won't stop emailing me. I don't know. I was still like having residual like anxieties and all this other stuff from COVID. And I just felt like, God, I would just really love to have a project right now. Cause I finished Maids in March, 2020, the weekend before everything closed for COVID. So like,
oh, wow.
I didn't have an idea for a new thing. I had all this extra time on my hands. You know, I was working remotely. I still am. You know, I've been remote now for like 6 years, which is great. But, I just wanted to get something out there. And I thought, you know, it's really difficult. And Maids, I loved that book, but, you know, it came out in 2020 and I just didn't get to do anything with it. We had had, you know, all these different like conferences and all this great stuff planned for me to go to. And then none of that happened. And it also just kind of felt like that book just like floated into the ether to like never be seen again, which was, you know, that was difficult and that was upsetting. And I like didn't want to do it again. And then, I was just like, you know what, let me just like do this stupid, like kind of throwaway story. I'll just put it out in issues and maybe it'll be like Sin City or something, you know, like it all revolves around this place. I'll just put out issues all the time. I can make a bunch of characters and how they interact with it and then how they intersect in each other's lives if they do, you know, and I just thought it would be something like that, like a bigger piece. And then I started writing, I was like, okay, so what's the in to this place? And it came through in this character named Dolly, who, you know, like has freshly turned 18, so she can get into this club and presumably work in it as well. And I just, she's kind of driven by something that like she doesn't understand. I didn't necessarily understand at the time. And that story just became like the centerpiece of it. And that was the one that I wanted to stick with and get through. And so it ended up becoming something where you're really more following this character than like seeing everything that this particular environment has to offer in terms of its own story. So yeah, it's just something like, honestly, you know, it was a big experiment. It took me a long time to make it just because I was working on it off and on. For the last, you know, 5 years or so. So yeah, I'm very happy with it. I'm very curious how it's going to be received because it does feel quite different for me. I don't know what the world at large would think or even care. So we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely follows what you've got with Maids in terms of being more personally character driven. Where with like Vampire and Agency, it's more like a bunch of chaotic vignettes. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really struck me about the book is it really, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a coming of age story, which feels very different for you as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried to resist like the great YA-ification of comics that I think happened from like 2014 to, I don't know,
presence.
Yeah. I was kind of, when I was getting started, I was also kind of like, okay, well, I'm putting these teenagers in it. So like anyone that, you know, wants to get mad at me for like not doing XYZ thing, well, like I'm giving you what you want. Here you go. Here's your little YA book. But of course that's not actually what it ended up being. It was like in between, like, am I don't know, doing Sin City or am I doing, I don't know. What's the Tilly Walden book, Spinning? Spin City.
Yeah.
It was one of those. I was between them and it ended up just being something else entirely.
It's just a different type of spinning.
Definitely.
With Dolly, and it strikes me as like her, it's not as much the location, but it's about her finding that kind of sense of identity and going through these things, these mistakes you make or adventures you take as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. How much of that of your own kind of life and experience did you kind of draw on and kind of thinking about your own adolescence when doing a work that pulls from that era?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I had braces when I was like 13, but I didn't rip them off myself with pliers. So otherwise everything is basically the same. No, I guess a lot of it is just like pulling from experiences that I had, feelings that I had, not like a one-to-one correlation really between anything, but it's obviously like that's the worst time. And for me, it was definitely difficult because like I knew I was leaving and I wasn't going to come back, you know? And so it was just this feeling of like, okay, am I able to trust myself on my own? And can I make decisions that will like bring me to what I ultimately want? And that was really hard. It was really hard, and feeling alone in that and feeling just unsupported. But at the same time, it's like also so exhilarating, you know? Like I used to love just as a teenager, like sitting around and thinking about what I could do and like what I could become, rather than, I don't know, looking at like, okay, well, you do XYZ step and then you do this and then you like become a teacher and then you like move to a house. And, you know, like I didn't relate to what a lot of like what people wanted from me and what the people around me were doing. And yeah, it just kind of feels like this character is just throwing herself into oblivion because it's interesting, like, because it's better than, I'd rather, you know, be in like oblivion than be in this place of uncertainty and fear where I'm just like, well, I don't know what could happen, you know? Like, I don't know what my future could be. I just like threw myself in it. I was like, no, I'm in New York now. Like, I work in New York. I'm a New Yorker. I'm a native New Yorker. And that's the end of the story, you know?
But you're not anymore.
Not anymore. I'm an Angelino now. Love LA. Love the Dodgers. I fit right in.
Well, I mean, they're originally from New York.
Yeah. There you go.
There we go. You know, you did this book while moving to LA. I mean, that's a big change.
Mm-hmm.
As well, and I'm wondering, kind of going through that, making that choice to upend and move to the other side of the country, mm-hmm. and a whole other climate and stuff,
mm-hmm. A whole other lifestyle, really, because I was, you know, it wasn't just moving to like be in this location, it was also moving to, you know, become a wife and start, you know, my own version of my own family, you know. So there was a lot of uncertainty there, and like it can be anxiety inducing no matter, you know, how great your partner is and how great your future is going to be and whatever. It still feels like, okay, well, is this like I'm throwing myself into oblivion again? Cause I just don't know, but I'd rather, again, take the chance than just kind of sit around and like wonder about it. So yeah, when I got started, it was like a couple months after I got here. And I didn't have like a drawing table or anything yet. And Jaime let me use one of his drawing boards. And so I was just like sitting at our kitchen table starting to draw heaven. And it was like, oh shit, it's like when I graduated from college and I moved home and I was drawing nurse on the floor, you know, in my parents' basement. Like we're back here again. I guess this is just how I cope. But that's good.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, you gotta have a, you know, that's part of the point of creating, is finding that kind of, I don't want to say it's catharsis. I don't feel like catharsis with this book, but it's definitely like a time of change.
Yeah. It's almost like it's just kind of like transferring it to a different dimension in a way, you know, it's like this, I'm externalizing it and I'm putting it somewhere else and I'm going to explore it here. And it's still, you know, those feelings are like still very much a part of my life and my consciousness, but there is something really affirming about being able to just like take it to the page and look at it from a different angle, you know?
There's also a sense of kind of perseverance and that kind of power of friendship,
mm-hmm.
and kind of how kind of going through stuff, having maybe going through stuff alone, but you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't really had the opportunity in a lot of the stories that I've done to like explore female friendship on like a more realistic sort of scale. And yes, this is a story about a haunted strip club. It's not realistic, but that group of four girls was like kind of loosely based on who I knew in high school and like who was around and who I thought was interesting. And I'm like pulling from, I don't know, different like fashion shoots and stuff to like try to like visualize them all in a space. Like there's one point where Sheila like takes an old dress out of Dolly's closet that's like clearly for children and tries it on. And I just like those moments. Like it just gives it a little bit of color. It gives it more character. And that's something I haven't necessarily built out in my comics. Cause I always feel like, you know, I just have to get this done. I don't have time for like little fun things. It just has to be like the story, point A to point B. And this, it feels like I had more of an opportunity to, I gave myself more of an opportunity to sort of detour and flesh it out with these little bits of color like that.
Is that something where you're thinking of like with your own change of the work you want to do is kind of how you're approaching your work and what you're kind of getting out of it for yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know why I'm doing all this, Robin. I wish I did, but we're still here, you know, like you said, I don't really know what I want out of the comics or even out of like a comics career at this point. I just know I keep getting closer to whatever it is. And that's just what drives me on. It's like the idea that like the next thing will be better because I will take this knowledge and apply it. And I'm still working a regular job. So it's like, I haven't had to compromise what I've wanted to do very much at all, you know, for better or worse. And yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. I turned 41 in February. I'm trying to figure out how this stays in my life or does it become my whole life or what, but I don't know. It's a good place to be, but it's also like can be a little frightening to really sit and sort of plot that stuff out.
Yeah, you're getting real existential with kind of where you want to be with your work or unsure of what you want to be with your work. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the book, you know, you talk about avoiding, you know, or not falling into the YA trap. And we talked earlier about the social media, you know, the avoiding social media. And I appreciate how you really kept this social media out of this, unless it really specifically served a purpose.
You mean in the story?
Yeah.
Well, it's boring. It's like, okay, it's a comic book. I can do whatever I want. I'm going to look at Facebook. Like, I'm painting the bars of my cage. No, I'm not going to do that. So yeah, that's, and also like, you really want to draw? You really want to take out the ruler and do all that? Really? You want to fucking be writex.com? No.
No. And it always dates comics for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like it places at a specific setting, a specific time, and it doesn't age well. And it's just, if you keep it as minimal and it just of service, it works. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always kind of love that cliche that's in movies where it's like, someone just tweeted something onto like the Interzone and like it's going viral and like someone's TV and like their phone and everything just starts going off and they're getting like a million notifications. I always love when there's a scene like that, but I didn't put anything like that in the book. I love it. Like shows can't resist doing that. You know, I feel like every show has to have a social media like detour moment now.
The setting feels like it's Southern California. Tell me how you embraced the deserts and kind of explored that world versus the very different city of the East Coast with Pittsburgh and New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one, it's a subtle detail, but it is in Nevada.
Okay.
And for, you know, cause I was thinking, I was originally thinking like, you know, of the strip club and I'm like, what do I want to call it? And I was thinking about, there's a strip club in Silent Hill 2 called Heaven's Night. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I like that. So I'm going to do a little bit of that. And then I also really like this idea of like, it just kind of not being there, like going on Yelp and being like, seeing, you know, I don't know what the hours are. Cause I don't even know where this place exists. Like I like that little mystery. But I've never been to Nevada myself, but I was thinking also like heaven and Las Vegas, like it's all there. It's all within state lines. So And again, it's just kind of like the imagination, but I did Operation Margarine and that was very much like a Southern California setting. And I did that before I got here before I'd seen LA for the first time. And I was like, oh, nice. I think this worked out. And the same thing happened in Nurse Nurse. I was like, I think this is kind of going to be what like Iceland feels like. And then I went there and it was. So it's like very cool, you know?
Love it. I want to talk about Viserys. I almost want to say Versace.
You can. Yeah. No problem.
Just staying on the Las Vegas tip. Mm-hmm. I really loved them, the anthologies.
And thank you.
Like, because I'm in Canada, I don't really do a lot of American Kickstarter things because it's just, it's expensive for me.
Yeah, understand.
And so I didn't read these sooner, but reading them in prep for it, they're fascinating and really neat how you've worked with these different creators to put together these books of ideas. And I'm interested of you taking on the role of editor versus artist, especially for the first book. I don't think you had any work in it. It's the second one that you had a short story in. Mm-hmm. And how kind of that feeling of taking a backseat and doing for other folks, like what you may want for yourself at all, or kind mm-hmm. of what that yeah. role plays for you.
Well, thank you. It was also another, so I started putting the idea together to do it in like 2023. And I remember I said once, like, I really would like to publish by the time I'm 40. Like, it's just interesting to me and I'd like to do that. And I remembered it that I had said that. And I was like, there's maybe like 0.5 other people in the world who remember that I said this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I did it. And it was also like getting out and going back to shows again, you know, after yeah. COVID, and like, just, it's a new landscape. I don't know if you feel that way, but there's a part of my mind that I'm just like, I'm still at SBX in like 2019, you know, like, but I was asking someone like, are you going to SBX? And they're like, no, that show is like completely different now. And I'm like, what are you talking about? There's no way. So I was getting out and going to shows and just seeing all these people whose work I'd never seen before, but it was like very exciting and very cool. And you know, it's one thing to like do your comic and like post it on Instagram or whatever, and that's fantastic. But it's another thing to be like, I'm putting this in print and like I'm getting to a show. That's a whole other level of commitment. And so I was meeting people that were doing that, you know, and I was just like, this work is great. It's raw. It's not like anything I'm seeing right now. Let me approach some of these people and see if they'd be interested in contributing work. And like, it's still like a very roughshod operation, and yeah. I need help for sure. I do. I've tried like having assistants and stuff like that, but it's very difficult. I basically just need like a manservant Hecubus to just like come up out of the ground and help me occasionally. I'm working, we're figuring it out, but yeah, I approached Annie Koyama for that first one, and she gave me a grant of $1,500 for Viserys number one, which was fantastic. So that also helped us kind of get a little bit of attention and momentum going and everything there. And yeah, put the Kickstarter together, worked with Coco Shinomiya on getting the book design done. And, you know, book design is like, it's just not something I think about. I have an idea of like the direction I want it to go in, but it's hard for me to like visualize something and then express it. It's just not my thing. But she did a fantastic job. I wanted them to look a little bit like 90s kind of zines, like maybe things that were sort of harsh, not antidote, but something that was going to be very distinct on a shelf full of like, again, not to pick on YA people, but you know, very like anodyne, like cute comics. And yeah. I like cute comics. I make cute comics. I have no problem with that. But I just wanted to offer something that was going to be a little bit more raw, a little bit more disgusting, challenging, and also just showcase artists that I think are fantastic. They're on their way or they're already established. And, you know, that's another thing is like, I'm very greedy. I would like to read more good stories. So why not invest in these people and get other people to invest in them, and then just keep the pyramid scheme going of getting all this great work and getting people paid.
The more than just the dollar, the same dollar that goes around the comic.
Yes, the dollar with silverfish on it that everyone gets.
Yeah.
I said, not this time. I'm going to take credit cards.
Yeah. I mean, comic shows are definitely very different now. I ran one for several years with VanCaf, and you're seeing such a mix of, like, there is some really fascinating stuff, and there's just a lot of stuff that I'm not into at all, but people are, and I don't understand it, and maybe I'm old, and that's where I don't take on the curatorial role anymore, because if it was me, it would be a very niche thing that not many people would attend. But it's just, yeah, there's such a wider breadth of audiences now and creators, and people are engaging with comics through all sorts of different ways than what we're used to 15 years ago.
Totally. And there's all these different points of entry that are really specific to, like, BubblesCon, I think about, because no one's tabling. They're listening. They're going to listen and watch, like, lectures about comics. It's not a, like, you know, set up your table for $50 and see what happens. And I'm just like, that's fascinating to me. And it works. And people go, and they really enjoy it. I'm like, what is this? And then, you know, you still have your regular shows. And then you have things out here, like, you know, we have this little show, Permanent Damage, that's really great. We have Kala, you know, but I'm just thinking of, like, those sort of big, like, indie blockbuster shows. I'm like, I don't know what those are anymore. Maybe that doesn't exist. Maybe everything has just kind of been fractured to such a degree that it's like, Virginia is the destination for, like, your comics lectures. And then, like, LA is where you go to get, like, art comics or whatever. You know what I mean? It's very splintered.
A lot of the bigger shows have also just gotten so embedded with the kind of comics publishing industry, or even, like, book publishers publishing comics industry. So there's such a like, collaboration between them. Because that's where these folks are trying to get their big special guests from. And it's interesting, but it's also like something with TCAF for a long time. I mean, I'm probably talking out of pocket, but I don't really care at this point. It where it felt too big for itself at a certain point. I don't know if you ever went to it.
I did. I went twice. And the first...
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first year... I definitely found it overwhelming, but I was also, like, so new, you know, this was what, like, 2008 or something crazy like that. And then the second time I went, that was maybe 10 years ago. And that was, like, a very good experience, but I was also more established, and I was on panels. I was on a panel with Darwin Cook, which is, like, crazy to think about. He was so nice to me. I always bring him up, and people are like, oh, Darwin, he could be, like, a little bit tricky. And I was like, he was really nice to me, and he read my book. So I don't know what to tell you. I don't know why you didn't get along, but, you know, I just had great experiences like that. Like, getting able to, you know, being able to, like, do this panel in a bar with Darwin Cook is really fun. And, but yeah, I don't really know, but, like, the fact that these things are still happening and people are still interested in showing up and, you know, taking the time, making the effort to not only make the comic, but print it and, you know, get somewhere and sit behind a table, do the humiliation ritual, you know, like, they're still doing it. And I'm grateful.
Yeah. It's, people are thirsty to make work, and people are thirsty to buy work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's just putting the time in to put that together. Mm-hmm. With the first book, you know, editing your kind of first thing like that, how did you kind of come across all the folks? Was it mainly through Instagram and things like that?
Yeah. Instagram was, like, a good jumping off point. And, but I met Face Fatigue, the story by Tia Roche that's in Visair One, which is the body horror, the body horror collection. I met her at a show in Philly in maybe, like, 2018, I want to say 2019. So this was pre-pandemic, but she gave me a copy of Face Fatigue, and I was just like, oh, what the fuck? Like, this is the most, like, fully formed thing I've seen in comics from a newcomer in a very, very long time. And so I was like, that's really exciting. Then I went to Autoptic in Minneapolis. That's where I met Jenna Chaw, Lonnie Nadler, you know, just seeing this kind of nasty, like sinewy, gross work. Corinne Halbert, I knew, I don't remember where I first came across Corinne, but I liked her work quite a lot. And I like what she's doing with Acid Nun. I think what she's doing is very cool. And Natalia Hernandez is my niece. So that's a little, she's a bit of a Nepo baby, but I think it was worth it. And no, she's fantastic. And jury's out. It might've been her first published story ever, but then I think someone else may have also published her. So I don't want to steal that.
She did do some mini comics.
Yeah. Get but out there.
That's different.
Know. Mm-hmm. And then Visser 2, which is the folk horror one, you know, Jay Webster Sharp, I met when I was in the UK. I knew her work before, but I got the chance to meet her while I was there, which was awesome. Get a book. She's so cool. Get fondant, get it signed. Like, yeah, she's super, super cool. And Sally, of course, is in there. Caroline Cash is in there, who, you know, like at this point needs no introduction. And I wanted to do a story. I was like, you know, let's do it. Like it's okay for the first volume to not have me in it, but at some point, like I am obviously a megalomaniac, so I did have to do something for it. And then I'm working very slowly on the third volume. That's okay. Going to be science fiction horror, and it's probably going to be next year. I think I'm pretty booked for the rest of 2026, but yeah, I have some exciting people that I'm talking to about that already. And yeah, it's rewarding. It's cool. And more than anything, I love that, you know, I send them their contributor copies. And it's like, now you can like go to a show and bring this, or like, if you're pitching something, you can be like, you know, I have this. I remember Chloe Brailsford, she did that mega story in the first volume, and she was able to take that and use it to pitch, you know, other projects and get those done. And yeah, that's really, really, really cool. I don't know if I wish I had something like that when I was getting started, because again, I don't know the full like scope of the impact yet, but it feels good to contribute something other than myself, but also like still get the same satisfaction of putting that project together.
One of the neat things, that I really liked with one of the stories, I think it was Erica Price's, and the second one is where she scanned the art from the original art, and you can tell, but it just makes it so much visceral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the anthologies themselves are like quite clean, you know, like the design is clean, got nice page weight in a way. It's kind of like almost like a magazine-y type feel. And then to just have something like lo-fi fucked up like a crazy scan, I think is a nice surprise, and I think it's cool. And I also like Erica's too, because it's like you got to take like a little magnifying glass to it and really like get in there.
Oh, I'm definitely at the age where I have to look at PDFs and expand them so I can look closer. It's a whole thing. I wonder if you can expand on, in the first book in your intro, you use the term body neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to kind of get more of what you mean by that.
I guess it's sort of, it was positive. It's just like a philosophy that's posited against body positivity, which I guess assumes that you should, you know, love your body, XYZ. You know, it's a very like outward facing thing. And then because I guess maybe that's an overwhelming philosophy, I also saw like the concept of body neutrality introduced. Like, it doesn't matter. Like I, you know, whatever's going on with someone's body, I'm not noticing it. I don't care what's going on with my body. I don't like, it's neutral. I'm like, that is not possible. I'm sorry. Like it's literally the most subjective experience. It's what you have. So
I don't
believe in positivity or neutrality or negativity. I kind of think it's just like everyone is figuring it out constantly, doing bodies and spaces. And yeah, I guess I just wanted to push against the idea that having a body was not subjective.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
I'm thinking on it. It's interesting. I mean, it's coming out when it did post, you know, post COVID, and people kind of have another different understanding of what body and space mean.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, I think you touched on this, is how the body is also, you know, potentially, you know, in the really deep fear mongering era of, you know, this lethal weapon of, you know, unknown chemical or unknown disease and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It's, you know, I like how you kind of come out of that with the body horror stuff. And because, you know, bodies are kind of gross and messy and disgusting and wonderful all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, what have we learned? You know, like we went through this horrible global pandemic. We went through this like horrible global pandemic. And the only thing I'm really seeing on the other side is like a bunch of hysteria about things that like kind of had nothing to do with it. Like, I don't know, like getting really worked up about like vaccines and masks and all this stuff. Like all of it is just kind of theater to avoid the actual monster in the room, which is this fucking disease that we don't understand. And yeah. At a certain point, you just kind of have to like put your head down and find a way to find glee again. And I think that's where a lot of these stories sort of come in. Like they are gleefully disgusting. They are so happy to be exploring a body, cutting open a body, eating someone, eating themselves, pulling out their intestine. Like it's fun. They're having fun. And I think that sort of like medieval gallows humor is good. Like I think we need it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like our bodies are so infinitely destructible, but we use the computer, we use the internet, and now we use AI and all this stuff that like is infinite and like capable of withstanding anything as long as you can like plug it in, you know, or like get internet connection. But like your body is a fucked up, dumb organ and you have to manage it constantly. Wouldn't it be kind of fun to see what would happen if I pulled my own intestines out? I'm at home, you know, I'm quarantined. Let's see.
When that inner voice comes through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you can't ignore the voice anymore. But yeah, I'm just so happy that like they all converged on this without knowing each other, without coordinating, without synchronizing, you know, watches. Everybody just kind of came through with these like gleefully disgusting stories. Like everyone is like a big Cronenberg head, very obviously. And I think that's fantastic. And Robin, I have to commend you. Because I understand you got a grant to do Inkstuds, to continue Inkstuds, very Cronenberg-esque. I hope it came from a tax shelter from dentists like Shivers was funded by.
I mean, I do have a special thing where I have a camera on a box of comics that's slowly rotting away and I just watch it from my living room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you saw the last Cronenberg, God, it was beautiful and painful.
The Crimes of the Future?
No.
Was there another one?
The one about the one he made after his wife passed.
Oh. Hmm.
And they basically they set up these things. Because wasn't Crime, was that the one by his son?
Crimes of the Future was him.
There was the one I'm thinking of is he did it after his wife died, and it's basically about a cemetery where you can have a live feed to watch the body decompose.
Let me make a note here. Something to do after dinner. okay, and that's not Brandon Cronenberg. That's
Daddy Cronenberg.
That's Daddy Cronenberg. Fuck, I missed it. Okay, you know what? I can miss sometimes. Even if I'm keeping the closest tabs, you know.
Yeah, I only saw it because it was on Criterion as a like debut on there for like mm-hmm. a week, and I was like, "Oh, I have to see this."
Interesting. Is it feature length or?
Yeah, yeah, huh. yeah.
See, that's the other thing. I don't know what the fuck is going on in the world anymore. There's a bunch of movies out that I'm like, ooh, I'd like to see that. Just float into the ether. I never hear them again. I don't believe that like surveillance culture is working, because why am I not getting ads for like the new David Cronenberg film?
Yeah.
Answer that, Silicon Valley.
Because they're not paying for them to promote the new Cronenberg movie.
I mean, that's a misstep for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where we're at now, where our social media feeds are curated, not based on our interests, but based on what other folks feel our interests should be to monetize.
Idiots. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
That's why I have to release propaganda through the podcast only. I have to be heard. I have to be, I need undivided attention.
The audio media to talk about the visual media. With your own podcasting, we talked a little bit about that, and kind of I'm interested in your staying old school and not being a couple of talking heads on a screen, and just kind of your interest in podcasting and kind of what you've gotten out of it historically.
Yeah, well, Sally does not want to be on camera, and that was an easy decision to make. We weren't going to do that, and I don't blame her. But yeah, it's. I'm so sorry. What was the question?
I think it was too much of a question. I mean, tell me about the kind of what you guys want to get out of the podcasting and the work that goes into it. Because like, you're not like when I look at a podcast like what you and Sally do, I'm like, that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Like, you're really thinking about what you want to talk about and talking about work. Like, in some ways, I feel like things this is quite laid back because it's just conversations. I'm not doing deep introspection on work beyond mm-hmm. our conversation.
I mean, I appreciate that. Thank you. I don't think we get as deep as others, I suppose, or perhaps maybe not as deep as I would like. I'm always like pushing it, and I want, you know, it's not that I want to like get to the bottom of a book. I just kind of want to understand who it was made for, why it was made, like where does it fall in this other spectrum of books that are coming out that we've been reading, like, and you know, Sally is at the Journal, so she's got, you know, a really good eye on things. She sees new books, you know, coming out, getting reviewed, that she thinks would be interesting to talk about. So we're lucky in that way. Because again, I'm missing stuff unless I'm like physically in person at a show, but Sally is way more tapped in. So yeah, for us, I mean, I think Sally, I don't want to speak for her, but I know that she like wants comics criticism sort of expanded. And I'm of the same mind. You know, it's difficult to sit and write, you know, a 2,000 word piece for the Comics Journal and get that same satisfaction out of it.
Yeah.
Because I like it, because in a way it's like we're figuring things out in real time. Like, you can kind of follow our thought processes and see where we end up. And yeah, it's a hard show to like even describe, because it's like, yeah, we talk about books and we talk about comics and there's no visual component. So like, what does that actually look like? And so that ends up us, you know, discussing the themes, kind of trying to figure out what the outlook is. Yeah, I would say that's it. It's very much like a layman's podcast with aspirations to be more. And those aspirations are mine, because Sally is like a perfect angel and she's doing everything properly, and I'm just like, no, I have to do better.
As you know, as an artist that's also taking on that criticism piece or being a critic piece, how does that affect your own process, kind of forcing yourself to be exposed to so much more work?
I see a lot better, I would say. I see things a lot differently, and I have an appreciation for the sort of bizarre idiosyncrasies that like every artist has. Like Kazuo Umez, people are running down the street, their legs are just like scissors. Like, it's one leg is out, the other one is also out, straight, both of them.
Yeah.
Just here I go down the street, you know, and they're always screaming. And every sentence ends in like two exclamation points, like conservatively, maybe one exclamation point. And I like going through and talking to a friend and being like, it's really cool that this keeps happening. We see it in Drift in Classroom. We see it in Orochi. Like, what can't this guy put exclamation marks on? So it was just
I'm
fun.
I'm reading Shingo right now.
Okay. How is the punctuation?
There's a lot of running and yelling.
See?
I think he is the best cartoonist at having children running and yelling scared. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone could top him.
Hard RIP for him.
The man who wore striped shirts all the time.
Yeah, had like a striped house. Yeah. Oh, he was so cool. I know. But yeah, I would say it's that. And it's also, you know, Sally has a very, I would say, encyclopedic knowledge of older comics that I don't know about. Like her sort of like mental library of American comics is much richer than mine. I'm way more haphazard. It's just kind of like what's interesting to me. I'm not trying to like read a full run of something. I'm not trying to, you know, be a completist with any particular artist, but she is someone that can be like, oh yeah, here's how it relates to like Little Nemo, Nancy, Calvin and Hobbes, like all the stuff that I'm just kind of like, I don't really know it as well.
Yeah. I mean, reading a Little Nemo comic is not easy.
It's not. First of all, they're big. Okay.
Yeah.
Too big. Get them a little smaller. Let me walk around with no, I don't know.
Put in a couple less panels there, hey, Lindsay.
How about you chill out? How about this kid just goes to bed? All right.
Stop giving him toast.
No more toast. No more dreams. Just night night.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah. Hmm. But anyway, she knows a lot more than I do. And then I just have my sort of niche interests in like manga and then European comics. And then I love reading, you know, sort of any of like the auxiliary material that people include when they do like an archival comic. I love reading translators' notes. I love reading, you know, intros, outros, just really like trying to meet the book at its level. And just talking about doing that and how we understand it. And, you know, we've been pretty lucky. Like no one has really ever like taken issue with our opinions or like our, I don't know, where we end up on a book. So yeah, so far so good.
I mean, podcasts, that's the great thing is like people really have to work hard to take umbrage.
Chester Brown got mad at us, though.
Huh?
I forgot. Chester Brown got mad at us.
That's kind of a badge.
I don't know if he got mad, but he took it to the blog, and he took it to the annotations, and I said, hey, let me read them. And I took the note. I was maybe a little mean on that episode, and I'm not mean anymore. So Chester won.
Chester is a delightfully kind man who is very specifically aware of the conversations that interest him. And it is fascinating. I am a regular follower of his Patreon, and I find it wild when it'll get into like a 3 long email thing dissecting one review of his book, because it wasn't just y'all. It's, you know,
you gotta chronicle your life. You know what I mean? Yeah. You're the only one to do it. Somebody's gotta be writing this stuff down and making notes. And really what he's doing is helping out a future comics historian. So I salute you, Chester. I saw your movie. I did my penance. I'm nicer on the show. I think we're all good, but you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, and the movie, actually, that's something interesting I want to talk with you about, is because you are a film buff. We've talked about Cronenberg, and you talk about a little bit in the Versailles of the difference, you know, that marketed difference between, or not marketed, but, you know, demarcated difference between comics and film. And I'm wondering about how, as a consumer, how they play a role in your life and kind of how you've gotten, you know, and I think Paying For It's a good example of kind of how those things worked in different ways for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, movies. I mean, it's funny because like I work peripherally in art, like working in museums and things like that. But then for the last like the last decade, actually, I've been working more peripheral to film, to like the film industry. And I have to be honest, does not seem appealing to me at all. Not a place I'd want to work, not a place I'd want to be. I'm good. I don't want to direct more than one person, and that is myself. Maybe two, you know, like I don't want to be involved in them. I'm not good with a group project, you know? So I just always look at film and I'm like, well, this is an exciting way to get new visuals, to get new ideas. You know, I love being like literate in film to a certain degree. I'm not obviously not, I don't have a PhD or anything like that, but I like to, you know, when like my other film heads are talking, I like to be able to like keep up a conversation. Gilbert is like great to talk to about movies. He knows everything. And when you introduce a movie to him that he's never seen and he watches it and he likes it, it's like manna from heaven. It's like the best feeling. So he's my film head that I'm going to these days. But I don't know. I've always loved movies. I suppose it's like a big psychological component. It's cathartic. It's colors. It's sounds. It's taking you out of your own life for a little bit. You can be a little, you don't have to be as involved as you would with a comic, but
there's a passivity.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's so funny you say that, because I remember one of the very first books I disagreed with as like a young person was Understanding Comics, because McLeod posits that like comics is the only active medium because you're doing the guesswork of what's between the panels and you're also reading. And I'm like, what about a movie? Like, what about an edit? What about a chapter break? Like, what are we talking about? So they're completely different. I don't think any form is better than the other, but it's just another way of experiencing narrative.
But it's always been kind of an influence that feeds into your work.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, it's easier for me to imagine a film than it is to imagine a comic. So I kind of start there.
Yeah. Were there any films in particular for Heaven that you would give a suggested watch list?
Oh, I mean, I can tell you, but I wouldn't even recommend watching them. Like, I would say like only God Forgives, Neon Demon. I love Nicholas Winding Refn. Like, he is a mess. I'm going to go see Her Private Hell at the one showing it's going to have in Los Angeles at the end of July. I will be there. And I love him. I love those big, stupid, lurid spaces. I love Argento for the same reason, Fulci. For Heaven specifically, I would say Only God Forgives, only in like the karaoke interludes or anything like that. The actual material of that film is like obscene. And what else? I don't know. I mean, I love Sofia Coppola. I feel like that's just in my DNA. Like I try to look at the world through that like Hero Max, like snapshot type filter. I like that. Jenna Jameson's How to Make Love Like a Porn Star, not a film, but the ripping the braces off comes from that.
Oh, okay.
I didn't do that personally. what else? I feel like that's kind of it. I'll think of more and I'll be kicking myself later.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with me today, Katie. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Robin, I'm so glad that you're back. It's great to have you back. Great to have Ink Studs out there on the airwaves again. Things are finally right in the world.
There we go. Changing the world of comics one listener at a time. So, you know, I've hit 5 people so far, I think.
Hell yeah.
No, I really appreciate it. And thank you for the kind words. And the new book is Heaven, out from Fantagraphics, as well as a slew of other works from the fine folks of Fanta, the agency, Maids, and My Pretty Vampire, as well as the Visser anthologies.
Can I be annoying and plug one thing? One
of
more
course.
Thing. I have a new tarot deck that's going to be coming out in October. And I'm not sure when this will come out, but the Kickstarter for it is running through July 16th. So if you have a chance and you'd like to back my new tarot deck, which is a reinvention of the tarot deck I did in 2018, this one's called Bad Girl Tarot 2, very original. But if you'd like to, look that up, pledge and support, I've got levels where you can get original art, all kinds of cool stuff. So I'm really excited about that. That's going to be so fun.
I will be posting this in a couple of weeks. So it'll be just before the closure. So
awesome. Get your wallets ready, everybody.
There we go. Find out what your future brings.